Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, biz is spelled B-I-Z. Please use this address as we are to start a mailing list which will then keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes and lots more. The address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who is a broadcaster, speaker, Christian author, and a cancer survivor, not once but twice. Our guest is a C-suite global advisor and a former senior executive at World Vision. Global strategy as a chief communications officer was part of her life, which included public affairs, social media, and involving over 500 communicators across 100 countries. Our guest was previously the editor-in-chief and associate publisher of PR Week, the communications industry main magazine. Our guest is now a preacher at St. Peter's and St. Paul's in Olney, Buckinghamshire, a church which has survived since the 14th century and where a certain hymn was written for the New Year's Day service in 1773. But what was that hymn? What does a C-suite global advisor mean? Why did she turn away from God as a teenager? Where did she go to study Buddhism? How would she describe her ME as an illness? How did she overcome cancer? Not once, but twice. Why is a new book entitled To the Ocean Floor? All these questions, better find the answers. And welcome to today's guest. It gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, Kate Nicholas. Kate, I almost said that all in one breath. Thank you for holding on.
I'm really impressed. And where you got all that information about me, goodness knows.
I'll tell you, Google is brilliant. And the back of your book is even better. So there you go. Oh, and also your website. So there's some good plugs there.
Thank you.
Where are we speaking to you from exactly then, please, today, Kate?
I'm actually in North Buckinghamshire. I'm about a mile from the town of Olney, which is where the church is that you mentioned.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing more about that.
And my home, sitting here in my home office, which is I'm surrounded by books.
Yes, including To the Ocean Floor in the background. Which is, I have to say, a beautiful cover. I really like it. It's worth checking it out at your local bookstore. Very nice indeed. So many questions to ask, but before we do, let's go for the five interest getter questions, if that's all right. Kate, if you're sitting comfortably, let's begin. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
These are amazing questions. They really made me think. My instinctive answer to that, of course, is Jesus, because what better than having God incarnate sitting in front of you to ask questions of? But I thought, considering I actually talk to him every day in prayer, that probably is not the answer.
Well, I don't know, actually, because someone else chose him. And I'm just thinking, well, do you know what? If you had a really nice bottle of wine, you could say, oh, I don't really like this. Could you just make it better? I mean, you could do that, couldn't you? I'm sure you wouldn't mind.
Love that, love that. But I have chosen somebody else.
Good, please.
So the person I would choose would be Francis Collins, who was the former director of the Human Genome Project. Ooh. And he's a leading scientist. He's also Christian. And he's one of the leading scientists who has claimed that as we look deeper into the universe, it requires both scientific and a theological worldview to make sense of existence.
Oh.
And I think I'd love to ask him what it felt like to penetrate so deeply into God's creation. I'm not sure we'd understand his answers. I'm not a scientist, but I'm fascinated by this intersection between science and faith.
Yeah.
Because it seems that the deeper we go, you know, as we look in the macro picture and look further out into the universe, people are now looking at kind of like, you know, what happened at the Big Bang.
Yes.
We're using the Hubble telescope to be able to understand that. And at a micro level into a quantum realm, the greater the mystery of our reality is becoming. We're finding that the world is a much more mysterious place than we could ever imagine. And I love that idea because that's where faith and science come together. That's where kind of rationalism and kind of this profound experience of God come together. So, yeah, no, I just think it's really exciting and I'd love to know more about it.
That is brilliant. I like that answer. And you'd be surprised to know that no one else has chosen that answer in all these years I've been doing it.
Oh, I'm glad to add.
Yes, you've got an exclusive there. Brilliant. I'd like to be involved in that question with you as well when you're sitting around the table having a nice meal. What meal would you have as a matter of interest? What would you cook him?
Oh, I'm a bit partial to seafood and fish. Yes. I could live without meat the rest of my life, but I couldn't live without fish.
And your favourite fish?
Sea bass.
If it's cooked well, then it's really good, isn't it? If it's cooked badly, then... Great answers. Thank you. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Kate?
Well, I can kind of roll them into one, really. Peter, of course, because he is so impetuous, flawed, but also faithful. And my favourite story is in Matthew 14. It's when, after feeding the 5,000, Jesus sends the disciples off in a boat across the Sea of Galilee. Yeah. And in the middle of the night, they see what they think is a ghost walking towards them on the water, and they're frankly terrified. And they hear this voice which says, "Take courage, it's me.
Yes.
Don't be afraid." And Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you." And so Jesus says, "Come." And then, without further hesitation, Peter steps out of the boat and starts to step out in faith and walks out in faith. It's probably the greatest, most breathtaking example of trust in the Bible. I think it's amazing. Of course, he then looked down and sank. But that doesn't diminish the fact that for a moment, he believed anything was possible. And he stepped out and he acted on that belief.
Yes.
And I think it's really interesting because we sometimes equate faith and trust. But in actual fact, faith is a noun. It's something we have. And trust is a verb. It requires us to do something. And you're trusting. Trust isn't passive. It isn't safe. It requires us to risk all, to be willing to step out of the boat, to maybe defy logic. Trusting in God's promise that when you pass through the waters, I'll be with you. So I think it's a really interesting example of what trust looks like.
Yeah, brilliant. Do you know what? I could listen to your sermon if you were ever going to do a sermon in a church and I wouldn't fall asleep. Brilliant. In fact, people forget that actually there have only ever been two people that walked on water on this earth.
Yeah. I'd love to also ask him at a dinner party, what did it feel like? Yeah.
Exactly. Just an aside, we're talking at the weekend and it was about Jesus' first ever miracle, which was the wedding feast in Cana. Mm. And this person suggested that the reason why they'd run out of wine was because all the disciples had turned up and they'd been sort of earthy people sort of thing. You know, they would have most probably drunk quite a bit of it.
I love that idea. I think one of the most fascinating things about Jesus is that, you know, we can sometimes, over history, people have tried to make him out as this terribly pious character.
Yeah.
Who was kind of so parsimonious, very puritanical. He wasn't. He loved a party.
Yeah.
I think it's really significant that his first miracle was turning water into wine so the party didn't fail. So, you know, I think he was very much about living life.
Yes.
In all its fullness, in every sense. And I love that about him.
Yeah. And it was for 3 days, that party as well. You know, it's like the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
Also said, me being me. Which one of the fishermen went there and said, "What, no beer? Have we only got to drink wine?" That might have happened. You just don't know, do you? Question 3. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, please, Kate?
Well, this is a really tough one because I don't want to be political, especially with an election coming up. And I'm a trustee of the charity Christians Against Poverty, which actually campaign works with churches and partners with churches to help alleviate UK poverty, particularly because of the impact of the cost of living crisis. And some of the stuff I see as trustee is shocking. You know, a new report from CAP shows that over half the people surveyed regularly skip meals and have been unable to heat their homes. And that's up by 50% from last year, which means that the impact's growing, not fading.
Yeah.
Over half have mental health issues because of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And a shocking half have attempted or committed considered suicide. And that's rising. That's up by 36% last year. So if I was Prime Minister, I would make tackling UK poverty an absolute top priority. And to help people recover from the cost of living crisis. And in particular, there's a particular call that CAP has, and it's to review Social Security and minimum wage to bring them in line with the minimum income standard so that people have enough to pay for the basics of life, eating, heating, you know, these kind of things. So that's what CAP are calling for. So I think if I was Prime Minister, that's what I'd do.
Don't know what else to say to that other than...
Some of the things I've seen are really... very shocking. And the churches are doing amazing work.
Yes.
They are really the front line and CAP's there to support them and enable them. And there are churches doing work with some of the most vulnerable people in society right now. Incredibly important work.
Well, as the future Prime Minister, if you've got thick skin, good luck with that. You should get it through.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sad to think you do have to have thick skin to get something like that through, but yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Question 4. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date, please, Kate?
That was a really hard one to pinpoint. I have spent a lot of time in my life travelling, personally and professionally. I've written a lot about this. I spent some time in Australia, living in Australia. I was working for UNICEF, and that's actually where I met my husband.
Ah.
And before we left, I'm married to an Aussie. Before we left, we spent 8 months travelling around Australia. And the day I remember most is probably not a conventional day out, but actually was in the outback. And I was sleeping on a swag, literally on the ground, at a place called Kalu Kalu, which is known in English as Devil's Marbles. And it's right out in the middle of the desert. And I woke up. I love waking up in unfamiliar places in the morning. And I woke up and I looked at, and the sky was completely red and the earth was completely red. It was extraordinary. Wow. And I remember sitting on a rock and looking out at this endless horizon in every direction. In this vast, arid wilderness, I had the most profound sense of God's presence. I think I understand a bit how indigenous people there regard the land as sacred. They have different beliefs, but the sense of God's presence there was so tangible. And it's something I've never really forgotten about. And I think it says something about experiencing God when we come into the wilderness, when we come away from civilization. It's really got me interested in wilderness experiences. And more recently, I've been very interested in the experiences of Jesus in the wilderness, Paul in the wilderness, and also what are called the desert fathers, who left society in the fourth century to go and live in the wilderness, try and get closer to God. And actually, I write about that a lot in my latest book, To the Ocean Floor. But yeah, it was an extraordinary day. Never forgotten it.
Wow. Fantastic. You know, just waking up and seeing all the stars, even if it's like red.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that if you go into the Aborigine history, or Aboriginal history, should I say, they talk about a great flood?
They do, yes. In fact, many of the world's civilizations and cultures actually have records of a great flood.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a point at which the earth began to become a water world long before humans existed. But there was a point in our kind of broader history, our longer term history, where the world did actually become a water world and land was completely covered many billions of years ago.
Every time people say the word water world, I keep thinking of that Kevin Costner film.
Yes, I know. Yes. I hesitated when I used the word.
And I went to see it at the cinema as well. Let's go for the final question then. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date, please, Kate?
Well, this one, there have been so many. I am terribly accident prone. When I worked as editor of PR Week, when I left, they made a front cover up of the magazine, which actually had various kind of stories about the various times I'd hurt myself and done something daft. But my favourite mortifying moment was actually when I was working for the UK Office of World Vision. I was campaigns and communications director there. And I was in the Dominican Republic. I was doing some work out there. And I was walking back at night with some colleagues, including the global communications chief, John, who was effectively my boss. He was the one who oversaw these 100 countries you mentioned. Now, I knew he was leaving and that he was considering who his replacement should be. And as I was walking along with him, I realised he was sounding me out and I got terribly excited and thought, oh my goodness, this is a big moment. And then everything went pear-shaped. And afterwards, John said, one moment you were there and the next moment you weren't. And he kind of was looking around for me. And eventually he looked down. And basically, the streets in the Dominican Republic were full of gaping holes. And I was so excited that I hadn't been looking. And I'd actually fallen right down into a foul-smelling storm drain.
No.
So my interview ended with my colleagues hauling me out of a slimy pit.
No.
Amazingly, I actually went on to get the job. But the story, as you can imagine, when I was appointed, did the rounds all around World Vision globally. And I earned the nickname Calamity Kate.
That's a very good nickname, though, isn't it?
So I'm known as Calamity Kate.
Were you able to sing the song as well? Oh, I just came in from the Windy City. The Windy City is mighty pretty, or something like that, isn't it? Calamity Jane, though, but it's worth a try. And of course, that interview that you had there and then in Dominican Republic, it didn't go down the drain, did it? Well, you did,
no,
but the interview didn't. Yeah.
No, I was very blessed. I went on and spent a good about 7-8 years working with World Vision. And it was the most extraordinary privilege. I worked with some of the most amazing people, Christian people who put their lives on the line around the world to help the most vulnerable, and also met many people of great faith in some of the most difficult circumstances in the world and some of the toughest places on the planet. It was only because I was diagnosed with cancer that period came to an end.
Yes, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
Very briefly on World Vision, what's the association between World Vision and Billy Graham organisation, or his son now?
Well, so Billy Graham, I believe, was a trustee at one point of World Vision. So that was he certainly knew Bob Pierce, who was the founder of World Vision originally. I believe that he was involved with Bob Pierce in the early days of World Vision, but that was a very long time ago now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for those answers. In my spiel right at the very beginning, I did mention a certain hymn. It's an amazing hymn.
Yes.
Tell us more about your church and the association with a certain John Newton, please.
Well, St. Peter and St. Paul in Oni, it's the 13th century or 1300s church. And John Newton actually his first position as an ordained minister. He was curate at Oney. And it was here that he wrote Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace is really about his journey. He was a truly troubled character in his youth. Mm. He was brought up as a Christian, but went off to sea at a very early age and was really quite depraved. In fact, he was so depraved that one of the merchant ships that he was on traded him with a slaver ship because they felt he was a bad influence on the rest of the sailors.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was there on that slaving trip when he was involved in slaving, he actually had this terrible, terrible incident at sea where he was nearly shipwrecked and which led to his conversion. And it was actually, this hymn is really about the fact that he was such a wretch. He talks about being such a wretch and that it was only God's amazing grace could possibly have actually turned his life around. I don't want to get into the Christian here a bit, but I stray into the Christian here a bit. But
oh, I should have said thank you. Right. Let's leave that.
Yes. There's a connection there. There's a connection there.
Good.
I'm not saying Newton isn't my hero. I don't want to kind of say, but there's another hero that is connected to him.
Oh, that's going to be very exciting. We'll find out then who that is. Thank you. So after leaving World Vision, you see he had the cancer. And obviously this brought in eventually not one but two books about the subject.
Mm.
Something else that you had as well, and that was ME. And that's a subject that's very close to my heart, as we discussed in a previous conversation. For those that think ME is still a yuppie flu or something like that, please just enlighten people as to what ME actually is and how it affected you, please.
Well, yes, I had what was then called chronic fatigue syndrome. I had a chest infection. I've always been a bit bad about my health. I've always tended to kind of believe in mind over matter and just power on through. And unfortunately, sometimes if you have a virus, you really do have to rest. And I was working in the media at the time. I had a very, very full-on job and I just carried on working until eventually I collapsed. And instead of recovering, I found myself bedbound for 5 months. I actually found that if I got out of bed to even just kind of go and get a glass of water or something, I'd have to go to sleep for about 3 or 4 hours to recover from it. It was really shocking. And I thought my life as I knew it had come to an end.
Yeah.
And I was actually a young mother at the time. And it was very distressing for the whole family. I was very, very blessed. And I actually had a very good doctor who looked holistically at the whole situation. And he managed to get me out of this step by step through a combination of, I didn't have medication, but it was really, he could have took me step by step back into activity again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people sadly don't recover from it. I did recover from it. However, I'm almost very aware that if it's there lurking in the background, and if ever I have a virus now, I respect it because it could resurface again. But it is a really shocking thing to happen. Thankfully, now it's near really being recognised now as an actual illness. And although there aren't, strictly speaking, ways to treat it, there are ways in which people can be manage their lives in order to actually try and come back to a certain level of activity.
Yes.
So I'm incredibly blessed. I'm saying God has been so good to me on so many occasions. And my energy did return full force. It took about a year and a half, but my energy did return full force. So, and I'm very conscious many others aren't in that situation.
Yeah.
There's no easy answer to it, unfortunately.
No. But it's interesting because I'd like to ask you then, when you had ME, this is before your cancer, which we will get onto in a few minutes. Where was your faith at the time and how much did you blame God?
I didn't have faith at the time. I was still in my wilderness. I was still in my wilderness years. I was brought up as a Christian. I was brought up as a Baptist by my mother.
Mm-hmm.
But just very briefly on my faith journey, my father was a rather tortured, brilliant poet. And he would have, these days, he would have been diagnosed as bipolar. But then he was very much kind of left to his own devices. And he was waging war at the world and at God. And he had suicidal episodes. He didn't die by his own hand, thank the Lord. But he had suicidal episodes. As a teenager, I found it very hard to reconcile this God that my mother talked about with my father's suffering and how he could allow him to suffer like this. And I actually turned to the church and asked them, and I didn't get an answer. So I turned my back on in anger on the church and probably on God as well. And I was about 17. And really, I then spent many years in the wilderness and I was a real seeker. You mentioned my straying into Buddhism. I was a real seeker. I was on this extraordinary journey because I realized when I looked back, I wrote my memoir, Sea Changed, about my very unconventional faith journey, as well as my healing from first cancer. But in it, I talk about the fact that it was as if I turned away from God, but God wasn't willing to let me go. And there was this journey and it took me, first of all, to a university in Aberystwyth. And I became very interested in Celtic Christianity, this idea you could experience God through creation, mm-hmm. Or understand God, the characteristics of God through creation. And I sort of wandered around the hillsides with my kind of sketchbooks. I had a period in my 20s, which was a spiritual wasteland, where I worked in advertising. But I then did actually go traveling. And when I was traveling, I began to really, I had the time to do some soul searching. And I studied Buddhism in the Dalai Lama school in Dharamshala in India. And I studied Theravada Buddhism in Thailand. And it was quite a turning point for me, because it was there I realized that a world without God didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. But it was some years before I finally kind of came back to faith. And I came back to the UK eventually and entered the very secular world of the newsroom. But it was actually a chance conversation that made me begin to read the Bible.
What happened?
I bought myself a copy of the Bible, and I read it cover to cover over two years going down the train to London while I was commuting. And I think having read this, I reached the conclusion, I think C.S. Lewis says it so well, that Jesus either had to be mad, bad, or he had to be who he said he was, the Son of God. And he was so utterly sane, and he spoke with greater sanity than any other human being has ever done. He was so self-evidently good to the point of self-sacrifice that I realized it had to be true. Mm. And it was at that point that I began to, I turned back to him. But the ME happened before that. And the ME, in that period where I was in that kind of wasteland still, it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Because I've since thought, I don't know how people go through illnesses like cancer without faith. Because I think the idea that somehow you are reliant upon your own strength to get through something like cancer is frightening. People talk about battling cancer, and I think it's because it gives you a sense of agency.
Yes.
But in actual fact, you're in a situation utterly outside of your control. I mean, come on to talk about this, but I think one of my big realizations was that I wasn't fighting this alone. In fact, I didn't need to fight to some extent, that actually God was fighting this for me. I can't imagine how someone faces something like cancer, faces their own mortality, relying entirely upon their own strength.
Yes. And I'm very aware as well that we've got so much to talk about and so little time. Mm. But also I want people to go and buy your book to the ocean floor, because otherwise, well, that's a great interview. You don't need to buy the book anymore. Yes, you do need to buy the book. All right. So we're only going to be talking the peripheries, because obviously with a book you can delve right in.
Absolutely.
Like a surgeon going right in with a knife and ferreting around to get out the cancer. What do you remember that time when you maybe felt unwell the first time and you go to the doctor and the doctor says, well, I've got some bad news for you? What happened then?
Oh, well, I was first diagnosed in 2014, and I was told at the first stage that it was inoperable, and my prognosis was not good at all. It has spread to the pericardial sac around my heart. It was breast cancer, stage 4. It spread to the pericardial sac around my heart and into the mediastinal area near the lungs and up under my collarbone. I actually Googled and found an article in a reputable medical journal that said 85% of people whose cancer spread as mine had died within 12 months. It was fairly bleak.
Yeah.
My memoir, Sea Change, which went on to be a bestseller for a while, actually, writes about this journey. It writes about my faith journey and this journey through the first cancer. And one of the things I talk about in it is that I think the most remarkable thing about my journey was that, well, obviously I'm here still and talking to you, which we'll come on to. No, actually, I'll tell you about that a bit first, because
please.
The extraordinary thing that happened was I was surrounded by prayer. I sought healing prayer, and I really immersed myself in prayer as soon as I knew what was happening. And actually, one of the extraordinary things is the cancer began to shrink before the first treatment. I went and had the first scan. I remember the radiologist said, oh, there's massive cancer, it's spread. I was like, oh, it's the last thing you want to hear. But then I went back for my pre-treatment scan before the chemo started 2 weeks later. And she scanned me again. She said, has your treatment started? And I thought, well, it was a bit of an odd question, because this is my pre-treatment scan, the benchmarking scan. But, you know, you don't tend to question. I think when you're in that situation, you feel very vulnerable. You don't tend to question the medics. But as I left, I felt prompted to turn around and said, why did you ask me that? And she said, well, it's very strange, she says, but the cancer shrunk, and by quite a lot. And I just said, well, there's a lot of people praying for me. Mm. And she put her hands up as if to say, well, I've got no other answer, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously the fact I'm here talking to you is a bit of a spoiler. but I actually went on. The chemotherapy worked so well that even though I was told it's inoperable, I ended up going on to have surgery, and they were able to remove most but not all of the cancer, and I was told I'd have radiotherapy to give me as much time with my family as possible.
Wow.
But I remember on March 28th, 2015, I went in to see the surgeon. It's a day I'll never forget. Remember, he didn't say anything. He looked at me long and hard, and we'd had discussions about faith. And he just turned around the report on his desk and he pointed at the bottom line and it said, there is no evidence of cancer in her body. Praise the Lord. Now, I don't understand why some people are healed and some are not. And that's one I struggle with terribly. And I write in my latest book, I wrote about one particular dear friend I lost, but I've lost quite a number of friends to cancer now.
Yes.
I think it's really important to say that I don't believe in fighting. I should don't advise anyone to ever fight cancer on a diet of prayer and carrots. Doctors are God's hands and feet, and all the wisdom behind all the extraordinary medications now available and treatments available come from God.
Yeah.
There is nothing outside of God's purview. So I'm always puzzled by people who say, well, I don't want to take medication because it diminishes my faith. Where do you think they got the wisdom from? Where do you think they got the ingredients from to create this medication? There's nothing lying beyond his purview. So I think that's really important to say. But I think what I came to realize is that God's healing, or what's called Rapha in the Bible, is something bigger than and may not always include a cure. Because I think the thing that was most extraordinary about my journey is I was sad, but I was never afraid.
Wow.
I remember when we were first told, my husband was sitting with me in that room when he was first told quite how dire the situation was. And my husband said, it was like there was this calm just descended over me. He said, Kate, I know it didn't come from you because you could worry the leg off a table. But when the oncologist kept saying to me, Kate, you do understand the implications of what I'm telling you, don't you? I said, yes, I do. And he couldn't believe how calm I was. And it wasn't that I was in denial. I actually did put my affairs in order. There's even a funeral plan. But somehow I was able to live with the idea that the world may continue without me in it, but also the idea of physical healing as well.
Yes.
And those two weren't in tension. And I think the only way I can describe that really is faith. And explain is faith, you know. The other thing was I had this intense and almost incandescent sense of the presence of God throughout it. And so I was desperately ill. And at points, it was as if I felt I was sort of standing on the border between the natural and the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I one of the things that I did during that journey was I was so ill. I've always lived my life at 100 miles an hour. And actually, God finally brought me to a standstill.
Well, maybe not a standstill. I brought you down to the speed limit of like...
He brought me down to the speed limit.
Yeah, 30.
And I was able to look back over my life for the first time. And I was able to see that what seemed to be the random occurrence of my life actually weren't so random after all. And that actually I could see how God's unseen hand had been guiding me all along and bringing me back to him and the way in which he'd shaped my journey. And that was extraordinary. And I thought of it as what I call my soul story. It's not just your life story. It's about something more than that. It's about that sense part of you that connects with God and how you experience God. And that's what I wrote in Sea Changed. And I actually initially wrote it for my kids.
All right, okay.
I didn't write it for publication. I didn't think I'd be around to publish it. I just really wanted my kids to know that I didn't want them to have the same experience I'd had watching someone suffer and to question God. I wanted them to understand how God had been there with me all along and how he'd lifted me up and how he'd supported me through that journey. And that was why I wrote my soul story in this book, Sea Changed, which then went on to change my life. I'd been a journalist all my life. I will say I've been a journalist. I've been a communicator all my life, but it took a cancer diagnosis to turn me into an author.
Yeah, that is fantastic. My wife, as you know, she had ME.
Yeah.
And that was miraculous how she came through that. And then through several other illnesses, leading up to the birth of our son and being in hospital for 3 months prior to the birth. And then shortly after, was being told that she had cancer. And we went round to see our vicar. And he said, oh, you two, what's the matter this time? And Alison said, oh, I've just come back. I've got cancer. And all three of us burst into laughter. Yeah. You would expect tears. But it was like we all burst into laughter. And I can't explain that, why we did it, but we did.
God gives you strength in the most extraordinary situations. I remember I was doing an interview with Premier Christian Radio, and the interviewer said to me, she said, Kate, it's really strange. It sounds almost like cancer was a gift. And I thought, well, what an extraordinary thing to say. And I thought, well, of course I wish I hadn't had cancer. I wish my family hadn't been through what they went through. But I can't wish away everything that came with it.
Such as?
Well, this sense of peace that passed all understanding. I've never had that sense of peace or that sense of God's presence so vibrantly in my life. And also, one of the extraordinary things that happened to me during this journey was I was given a passage at the outset, Jeremiah 29:11. I will not die, but will live and declare the works of the Lord. And I think I held on to that like a life raft throughout it, throughout my journey. But when, against all odds, I survived, I decided that had to be the mission of my life. And I wasn't sure what that would look like. But since then, God just opened doors in the most incredible way. And so, first of all, I published Sea Changed. Mm-hmm. I found that I was being invited to speak all over the country. I've now spoken all over the world about my journey and about my story, and being able to meet other people with the most incredible stories. And I often say I love doing talks, but what I love most of all is talking to other people afterwards and hearing their stories.
Yeah.
One of the other books I wrote was called Soul Scribe, How to Understand and Share Your Soul Story, because I realized that everybody else had got these amazing stories to tell. And I wanted to use my kind of experience as a professional communicator to help people to understand their story and also to be able to share it. I remember I went for an interview about my book with TBN, the Christian television channel. At the end of it, Leon Showman, who interviewed me on TBN Meet, said, "Kate, I think God's doing something really amazing through you." He said, "I think I've got to offer your own TV show." I nearly fell off my chair. I thought, this is... I was 55. You know, I'd worked in broadcast media. I'd done some work with the BBC and things and various other channels. Women do not get to be made presenters at the age of 55. Couldn't have made it up, you know. God was doing these extraordinary things and opening all these doors for me. And so how could I wish all that away? And none of that would have happened if I hadn't had that experience of cancer to come so close to him. I don't believe for a moment God did that to me. I don't believe God does that. I don't believe that's the way the world works, going back to science and faith. But I do believe that he can use all of our circumstances, including the most challenging, to transform us, but also use us to help transform others as well.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it's what my TBN show ended up being about. It's called Living a Transformed Life. And in it, I look at the idea that God seeks to transform us. God is a God. Our God is one of transformation. He seeks ultimately to transform us into the likeness of his son, Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Many people have amazing conversion experiences, but I think Paul talks about what's called an anakinosis, which is a gradual renewing of the mind. And I think many people, their coming to Christ can be rather like mine, a rather slower experience. And that God uses various circumstances in our life to help us on that journey. That might be those we encounter, the people around us. I don't know about you, but I often find that with synchronicities, you find certain things happen and what I call God incidences.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll come into contact with a person at a certain time. A certain piece of information comes to a certain time that changes your view of something. So as a Christian, lots of pieces of scripture come to you just at the right time that actually make you think in a different way. And I think we live our lives as Christians, all right, as human beings, we are meant to live our lives in change. We are meant to embrace change, and we are meant to, our life is a journey of change and of transformation. What I do think, though, is I think sometimes some of the great challenges in our lives fast track that change and fast track that transformation.
Let me throw a curveball at you. Obviously, being married to an Australian, I can talk more about cricket than curveballs, you know, because that's like baseball, isn't it? So let me throw a seamer down at you. I love the expression, how do you spell faith? And it's R-I-S-K.
Oh, yes, yes.
Risk. And you're talking about change. You're talking about risk. Is it the same thing or different? What do you think?
Well, I think it's what, in a way, going back to the first one, the questions you asked me, and when I talked about Peter, so this idea that trust is not passive. We talk about trusting in God, but that means that we have to be willing to actually step out. And some things that he asks us to do in our lives seem to defy logic. My husband has always said that I specialise in jumping off cliffs.
or storm drains.
My career has been slightly strange. I started out in journalism and I worked my way to the very top of journalism. I was one of the most senior female publishers in the UK. And I felt that God was calling me out of that. And I stepped off the edge of a cliff and went and worked for a charity, World Vision. Which at the time, I used to joke that it was the salary size of my shoe budget.
I can identify with that as well. Same thing, yeah.
When I got into working the charity, I sort of started out in quite a lowly role and I ended up being the global communications chief. And again, so this time I was more pushed off a cliff by cancer, but I stepped out and then started out as an author and really focusing on my life as work in the church. Although one thing I do want to add, because mm-hmm. I have to give tribute to them for this, I didn't leave World Vision until after I'd had the cancer. They were so amazing how they supported me.
Good.
If I was off for a year with cancer treatment, I was surrounded by prayer. They could not have been better.
Good.
I think I knew that I wasn't meant to go back to them, but I went back out of a sense of sheer loyalty. And also I loved the people there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I knew that God was calling me out to do something different. And so an opportunity came up to step out and they were doing some reshuffling. Yes. And I saw then, I thought, actually, I know God's now telling me, you've got to step off the cliff again.
Yes.
You've got to leave this behind. Yeah, and before all that, I very first started out in advertising. And I did the same thing there when I went off traveling. So my husband says I'm a bit of a cliff jumper. I'm not averse to risk.
Well, I'm going to bowl a googly at you again now.
Yeah.
I think you've already alluded to this. But for those that are listening today and have experienced the fact that they feel desolate from God, they don't know what's going on, you could easily say, oh, well, the reason you survived was because you were in World Vision, emails, everything else, the whole world and his dog in World Vision must have been praying for you. That's, you know, reason why I survived. Me, I haven't got anybody. So who's going to pray for me? What would you say?
It's a really complex one. Mm. One of the key things I would say is that when you look at Jesus' own model of ministry, his own healing ministry, yes, he did heal some people because they had faith. But I always look at this story of kind of the man, of the pool of Bethsaida. Because there was a guy there who'd been crippled, I think it was 38 years, he'd been lying there, trying to get his way into a kind of what was a pagan pool that pagans believed could heal them. So he definitely wasn't a Christian. He didn't have anyone around for him praying for him. He didn't have anyone around for him as a Christian. He was fundamentally a pagan. But Jesus came to him and healed him. He didn't even know who Jesus was. When the temple authorities asked him afterwards, who healed you? He didn't even know who the temple authorities were. None of us understand the exact kind of relationship between prayer and healing. In my book, To the Ocean Floor, I do look a little bit into some of the research that has taken place around this. There's been some research that's looked at the fact that directive prayers, you know, I pray that so-and-so is going to have this operation and this operation is going to be successful, don't always seem to be quite as successful, if there is such a word, as non-directive prayers. And I think one of the things that I really did learn through my cancer journey was, you know, we talked about this idea of battling with cancer. I started off really praying, Lord, I pray this test result will show this.
Yes.
But I eventually, through an extraordinary experience I had in my second cancer journey, realized the power of what I call surrender, and actually learned to pray, thy will be done, and actually mean it. Because many of us say that, but do we actually mean it? There is a letting go, I think, that sometimes has to happen.
Yes.
Yeah. So which I can talk about, because that was really the journey I went on in my second cancer journey.
Well, let me bring in on that. And the reason why I'm smiling when you said thy will be done was because in your book, you've got a quote there from Charles de Foucauld. I think I said his name badly, but I had to Google him as a result. It's otherwise known as a prayer of abandon. And yeah, I was blown away. Do you know what? I was thinking you'd actually might choose him as your Christian hero. We'll find out in a minute, but obviously not.
Interesting idea, yes.
So I want to say battling against cancer is similar to his prayer, thy will be done, which you talk about. Yeah. So tell us more.
First of all, I'll tell you what happened is that after seven years in wonderful remission, in 2021, in the midst of the pandemic, I found a routine mammogram showed the cancer had come back. Mm-hmm. And it showed it had come back, and I quickly learned it had come back with a vengeance, and it was really aggressive. I want to say one thing now. Ladies, please go and have a mammogram if you're offered one. Gentlemen, if one of your loved ones is offered a mammogram, please go and have one, because they save lives. It saved my life.
Yes.
It's fair to say that I think I felt like I was cast into the wilderness a bit. You know, I'd been doing all this stuff. I'd been declaring the works of the Lord. And I think to begin with, I was left with this feeling, well, what have I been doing wrong?
Yeah.
You know, there's a wonderful word in Hebrew, which is used for to wait in the Bible. And it's kawa. And kawa means to wait in expectation of what God might do. And so I felt I was being challenged to kawa. What happened is, and I'll explain this experience because it helps to explain what I meant about abandonment. I started chemotherapy, and in the early stages, I got very, very ill with sepsis.
Oh, right.
And I became terribly ill with it. And I had this experience of God, which really, I think, goes beyond words. It's what you call an apophatic experience. And I wonder if I can just read you one couple of passages out of the book, because
please,
as a writer, having an experience that goes beyond words is a very hard thing, is a very quite challenge as a writer. But this is just a little bit of when I try to explain what happened to me. I am vaguely aware of being wheeled down through the labyrinthine corridors of the hospital to the acute medical unit, where I'm placed in an isolation room. As the door closes, I once again descend, down through the waters, away from the light, slowly, gently, until my limbs settle gently on the distant ocean floor. Swaddled in the stillness of the deep, enveloped in silence, all conscious thought ebbs away on the tide. I bathe in the stillness and silence permeates my soul. Lulled by the invisible rhythm of the depths, time loses its meaning. Dreams meld with reality as I rest on the far seabed. Until gradually, in that liminal space, I begin to sense something other, the numinous, a presence vast and uncontained, indefinable but tangible, an encounter with something endless and eternal, there in the pressing water. And together we wait in silence, rocked in the arms of the deep.
Wow. Do you know what? Before we get back to the subject, you can see the gift of your father in you in that. That was almost poetic, wasn't it?
One thing that was really interesting, because I really struggled with how to write this.
Wow.
And it was a bit that the Holy Spirit almost took over. And there are points in the book where prose melds into poetry. It was as if words began to kind of form themselves in unfamiliar patterns. A lot of authors say they look back and say, like, did I write that? And I certainly have felt that with this book. It was as if the Holy Spirit was writing through me at times.
Wow.
I started writing poetry since, actually. Not that I'd publish any of it.
Well, it was brilliant. Well, and just to encourage you, because at the very beginning, before we went live, you said, can I read a passage? I said, of course you can. And me being me, said, and if you could do it in the style of Richard Burton. And the reason I say that is one of the greatest records ever made, Jeff Wayne's musical War of the Worlds, which Richard Burton narrates.
Yes,
and the way he speaks, no one would have believed. Mine's immeasurably superior. And I thought you were Richard Burton, seriously.
That's bless you.
The way you hear it, brilliant.
I've actually just recorded this book for Audible, and my publisher and the recording company decided that they'd get me to read it.
Yes.
I mean, it was a wonderful experience actually reading it through.
Brilliant.
And could almost reliving some of what I went through, but also the extraordinary things that happened.
So tell me more then about the second cancer.
So yeah, so when I recovered from that first incident, I had a grand total of 2 years of treatment. I was very seriously ill. But when I recovered from the first treatment, that first incident, I began to suffer from what I'd almost call a kind of sense of nostalgia. There was this intensity of this experience, which that's only part of the description of it.
Yes.
And I found myself wanting to almost, this sounds strange thing to say, recapture it, almost go into the depths again. And I started to look back at those wilderness experiences and the contemplative traditions that emerged out of them. So, for example, particularly the Desert Fathers. So there are contemplative traditions that go right the way back to the dawn of Christianity, to Paul, to the Desert Fathers, which were developed by medieval mystics. And there've been modern masters such as John Mayne and B. Griffiths who also looked at these traditions.
Mm.
And in the book, I talk a lot about these traditions and describe a lot of them. And as I explored, I realized I was being taken on a journey of growth. I've always been, you can probably tell, a raving extrovert. I love being part of my church family. I'm on the ministry team. I love the work, the life of the church. What this tradition was teaching was about seeking God in solitude and silence. It's interesting, the Desert Fathers, the word to describe them is monachos, which of course is from which we take the word monastery. I remember my sister once saying to me, you're going to have to adopt a monk-like approach to this period in your life. Because, yeah, of course, I was in isolation rooms most of the time. I had no immune system. And COVID was rampant. And even my husband worked in school. My youngest child was in school. And I had to isolate from them as well because they were bringing bugs home.
Yes.
And so what I realised that God was teaching me to connect with this more introverted side of my personality. And I think there's also a journey from rationalism, I think, as well, because, you know, I'm an ex-current affairs journalist and I've studied theology. I very definitely had a head approach to my faith. But again, this tradition was teaching me to encompass, a kind of embrace an experience that goes really beyond reason.
Yes.
And it's interesting, through the process, I began to explore Christian meditation. Now, during all my time in the East and my travels, I did study meditation. So I was a bit kind of concerned about this because a lot of these traditions are meditative, these contemplative traditions. But I realized quite quickly that actually they're very different from the Eastern Buddhist type meditation, in that what they're seeking is not a sort of negation of self, but they're seeking an experience of God. Basically, they're seeking to be still and know that he is God. And it was really interesting. In fact, B. Griffiths, fascinating writer, I talk about him a lot in here, fascinating spiritual master. He was a Benedictine monk who went out to India and established an ashram, a Christian ashram, to try and understand the linkages between the East and the West. And his view was that in the West, our rationalist approach means that we've lost sight of the sheer mystery of God.
Yes.
There's a writer called Richard Rohr, who is incredible, who talks about the two halves of life. And he says there's two halves to our faith life. In the first part of life is very much about control and about understanding. But the second half of our life, our faith life, is about embracing some of the paradoxes that exist in the Bible, for example, some of the paradoxes of faith. It's no longer so much about questioning, it's about embracing the sheer mystery of God. And I think what I realized is that these traditions and my experience were pointing me towards this second half of life faith. Which brings me to this idea of abandonment, because actually, when you embrace the sheer mystery of his faith, sheer mystery of our reality, the sheer mystery of God, we realize that his thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are above our ways. And so I think then you're more able to trust, to actually take the risk of saying, Lord, thy will be done.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer, but you do.
Yeah.
And in our weakness, his power is made perfect, as we're told in the Bible.
Yes. And those people are saying, Desert Fathers, who are they? Is that anything to do with Lauren Hardy? No.
No.
That's another thing.
There were a series of early Christians who, when the state started embracing Christianity and started putting in place a lot of rules, they felt that actually, they, in order to actually get back to the very early church, Jesus' idea of church, and they actually moved away from the cities, where it was becoming more institutionalized. And so they went out into the wilderness and very much led by Jesus' experience in the wilderness.
Yes.
So that they were very much inspired by this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Get out there and just contemplate. And as you say,
exactly.
It was put very nicely to me by Peter Mockford, who has done a couple of podcasts with us, the last one being on prayer and mental health. And two things I'd like to say as a result of that. First of all, if you've been prayed for and you feel you've been healed, still go to the doctors, please.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Please. Absolutely. Yes, yes, absolutely.
And the second thing was so important, I forgot what it was. But obviously, it was mind-blowing on what Peter would have said on that. I'm aware of the time as well, and I think it's only fair to say, I'm going to throw a bouncer at you here now, all right? Give me just one reason why people should rush out today and buy a book, please. Apart from the fact that you need the kerosene for your private jet to fly around the world from the sales of this book.
Ultimately, this is a book about hope. My journey wasn't easy. It did take me to the borders of life and death. In fact, at one point, I do come very, very close to death. People have asked me, is what you experienced delirium? Was it a result of having sepsis?
Yeah.
The reason I know that it's not is because when I came to the point of nearly dying, something extraordinary happened, which made me realise and validated the experience. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because you've got to read the book.
Well said. It's about hope. It's about Charles de Foucault as well, the prayer of abandon. Please just go onto Wikipedia and read his life. Wow.
Yeah.
What a step of faith that was and what happened to him. So I love the thing you can just encapsulate it all in hope. I'm also very much aware of the time and just want to say, for those who want to know more about sepsis, then a podcast with Dave Carson, one of the ambassadors for the Sepsis Trust, he explains more about what it's like to be a Christian and then lose both your legs as a result of having sepsis. So we've covered that in a podcast.
Brilliant.
Kate, we've given enough breadcrumbs thrown into the water about the Christian hero. So drum roll, please. Kate Nicholas, who is your Christian hero, please?
So you might think I'd choose the contemplative, but in actual fact, what I would say is that one of the key things about my experience is it changed the way I saw the world.
Ooh.
And I realized that actually meditation and contemplative traditions are not about kind of self-centeredness or kind of self-focus. They are actually, about equipping you to go back out into the world. So the person I've chosen was very much in the world, and it's William Wilberforce.
Ah.
Who, with the aid of John Newton, the former slave trader who wrote and wrote Amazing Grace, helped to bring about the abolition of the slave trade. Now, when Wilberforce entered politics as a young man, he was almost as depraved as John Newton was. He was very much known for his social life and for drinking and gambling. But about 4 years after entering politics, he embraced Christianity. John Newton was very much his mentor. And initially he went to him and said, well, if I come out as a Christian, I'm going to be scorned in Parliament. So I'm going to have to leave politics. But John Newton persuaded him to stay. He said, stay put. You've been put there for a purpose. And Wilberforce realised that that purpose was actually to bring about the suppression of the slave trade. Because he was absolutely horrified, along with a lot of other people, particularly other Christians in what's called the Clapham sect, by the greed of the owners and traders and the sheer cruelty and depravity of the slave trade.
Yes.
But as he spoke out, it seems amazing now, but he met huge resistance. He had assassination attempts on him. He was beaten at one point by an irate sea captain. He had tirades against him in Parliament, and there were various rumours about his morality. And his health was very frail, which is another reason I'm interested in him. He could have very easily just backed away.
Yes.
And he had repeated illnesses, but he stuck to his guns for 20 years and he fought along with others to turn the tide of political and public opinion until in 1807, the House of Commons in the UK voted to abolish the slave trade by a huge majority. His journal says he sat there and wept as others cheered this going through. Then for 25 years after that, he spent his time berating other nations to do exactly the same. Until 1833, 3 days before he died, the House of Commons passed a law emancipating all slaves in the British Empire. Now, I'm interested in Wilberforce, partly because of John Newton, because I preach in the church where he wrote Amazing Grace, and also because I'm working on a forthcoming book about John Newton, and includes his relationship with William Wilberforce. But I'm also interested because although this trade has changed, there are still 50 million slaves in the world today. And we desperately need a 21st century Wilberforce.
Yes. And somebody listening today might be that person.
Yep.
You might also have to realise that it takes 20 years or more to see the change happen. But you stick to your guns, you can do it. If you imagine 30, 40 years ago, if we said the words New Age in a sentence as a Christian, you know, you'd go, oh, New Age, we've got to touch that. It's all New Age. And yeah, hang on, we've talked about meditation, which if you look in the Bible, is there.
Yeah.
It's all about the founding fathers, the desert fathers, should I say, to live almost a reclusive life. That would have been deemed 30, 40 years ago. Sometimes we have to get rid of our mindset.
Absolutely. So this is really ancient, you know. Psalm 46:10 says, be still and know that I am God. This is actually just simply going back to a very, very ancient form of Christianity that was espoused by the very first Christians, the disciples. So, yeah, Paul, I talk in the book about Paul and his focus on these traditions as well. So he was very much involved in kind of a contemporary form of meditation.
Yes.
Tom Wright's written a wonderful book called Paul, in which he believes that actually it was this which partly led to this kind of Road to Damascus moment, which is really interesting.
Well, I'm looking forward to catching up with you again in a future podcast, maybe in 20 years' time, and say, what have you been doing in the past 20 years? You know, we could wax lyrical over a cup of coffee or something stronger. Kate Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us today. Your book is called To the Ocean Floor. A previous book is called Sea Changed, that's C as in S-E-A. All good Christian bookshops and other people online are selling it.
Can I also add, my website is katenicholas.co.uk and there are links there to books and there's lots more information. There's my online courses, there's Bible studies, there's all sorts of stuff on there, my TV show on there.
I'm sorry, you haven't got time. Was it katenicholas.co.uk?
katenicholas.co.uk, yeah.
Brilliant. And Nicholas is spelled N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S as well. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been incredible. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
God bless.